If you eat out a lot, you may have noticed how suddenly everywhere you look, there's a certain dish or ingredient on the menu, or the menu itself is made out of a certain kind of paper, or the server handing you that menu is wearing the same kind of shirt. Joining me now to talk about restaurant trends, where they come from, and why some have staying power and others don't, is Adam Platt, food critic for New York Magazine, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show. We also want to hear from you. What food trends have you been noticing? Are there ingredients that you see suddenly popping up all over the menus in every restaurant? Do they drive you nuts or do you like them? Call us at 212-433-9692. Write us on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook, and you can even tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Hi, Adam.
How are you, sir?
At the end of last year, you wrote a piece in the Where to Eat issue of New York Magazine called The 10 Trends We're Tired Of. And your list included overlong tasting menus and what you call effete tasting restaurants. Why do you want that menu to this moment to be over?
Well, the thing about the moments in sort of the food world, they last, then they sort of go away. Right now, when I first started reviewing restaurants, a little over 10 years ago, the grand restaurants were in these huge rooms. The huge rooms were manned by fleets of waiters in tuxedos. They told you, basically guided you through the meal. There were lavish choices. You could pick this and that. Now everything seems to have shrunk. So the effete, highly ambitious restaurants, and it's for a whole bunch of different reasons, but the effete restaurants tend to be tiny, out-of-the-way places. Often you're not even eating at tables, you're eating at a bar. Maybe there are 12 seats, maybe there are 4 seats. The chef, it's almost sort of a priestly atmosphere, and it comes from a whole different, lots of different places, but the chef will basically feed you what is fresh that day, what happens to be on his mind, and what he thinks you'll like. And so you devour this food, not really in a sort of a natural sort of, you know, sort of bacchanalian way, but in a very carefully measured way. And it can be a little exhausting sometimes.
Well, some of what you say is what we get from other countries. In France, there are these small restaurants in small towns mm-hmm. where the chef cooks whatever was on the market that day. The same thing happens in Chinese restaurants. Mm-hmm. But where almost everything is a special except what they give us on the lo fan menu. Some of those other things, that small restaurant, they often still have large wait staffs. And there, I just had this experience recently where I felt like I was being hovered over because there wasn't a lot of space for them. Mm-hmm. And then they just rushed me through a tasting menu that I found to be largely mediocre. But the whole thing, I had a long tasting menu, and it was less than an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing about tasting menus, I mean, critics generally, if you're a professional critic, you generally shy away from tasting menus. I mean,
But isn't that where a chef shows you what he or she can really do?
Yeah, they show you too much sometimes. And so what happens if you're in a restaurant which is serving a la carte dishes, and they also have the tasting menu? First of all, if you're a critic, you're eating all the time, and so you don't really want to spend 4 hours eating 15 different dishes. That's number one. Number two is that if you're in a regular a la carte restaurant, it's not often it's a very mannered side of what you're really going to get if you actually go to that place. Now, the tasting rooms that we're talking about, the tradition that they're sort of aping is really the Japanese omakase tradition, which if you go to Japan, you know, the great sushi restaurants are very small. They're at bars. They serve you 15 carefully fashioned pieces of fish that are fresh that day. You don't talk to the chef. He doesn't talk to you. You pretty much eat what you get, and which is it can be a quite a relaxing, zen-like way to enjoy your food. And the first person to do it's been done by a lot of different chefs in New York, there are various Japanese chefs who do it, but the one who popularized it, I think, for this generation is David Chang at his tasting bar, Momofuku Ko, which opened, 6, 7, 8 years ago? Mm-hmm. Anyway, Chang is sort of a model for he's sort of a model for young chefs, and they copy what he does. And so this, it's led to sort of an explosion of this kind of tasting bar.
Well, there's another restaurant in Brooklyn, a very modest place where you sit at stools called the Chef's Table, that now has become incredibly expensive. But it got 3 Michelin stars, and I don't know how many courses come out. It's something like 20 different courses.
A lot of different courses.
And a lot of people seem to be imitating him because he's done so well.
Yeah, well, he... Chef's Table, I mean, we could talk a long time about Chef's Table. It's a combination of trends. It is the omakase trend, although the chef there is actually one of the reasons he got the Michelin stars is his food is very Michelin friendly. It's really quite sort of a, you know, there are a lot of fancy ingredients. There's a sort of a tinge of the Asian Japanese influence, but it's, you know, there's caviar, things like that. It's actually stuff that if you've eaten at Michelin restaurants, you've seen it a lot before. However, it is served in this rustic. I haven't been there recently, but I went there when it first opened. It's served in this rustic, sort of Brooklyn environment. Which rustic's the wrong word? What's the word I'm searching for? You know what I'm searching for? When I went there,
it's kind of rough. It's actually been carved out of a supermarket.
Right. When I went there for the first time, they messed my reservation up, and so they said, "Will you please come back in a couple of hours? There's a good bar down the street." So it's like, it takes a million years to get your reservation. So I went to the bar down the street, I came back, this delicious food started arriving, beautifully fashioned. And I said, "Well, what sort of wines do you have?" And the guy next to me goes, "Didn't you know this is a BYOB place?" Which is what it was known for. Now it's got one of the most expensive wine lists in the city. But in those days, that's what it was. And that sort of added to the charm. But also, it also gave people something to write about, which is what's important in this world also.
Another trend that you say you're over is fetishized vegetables. Isn't that an outgrowth of the local food movement?
Right. Well, the thing about New York food in general, everything's become simpler, but it's also become, being New York has become more fetishized. So for vegetarian, it's a personal choice. I'm probably like you, I'll eat anything. And the vegetables, I love vegetables, but just in and of themselves, worried over endlessly, it becomes a little tiring.
I once saw a plate of heirloom carrots with some other vegetables for $22 on the menu at a Brooklyn restaurant. It chased me away, actually.
Well, I think I mentioned that in my overrated list also. It's like, carrots for whatever. Daniel Hum, who's a wonderful chef, his restaurant Nomad is famous for these. I think they're carrots, which are incredibly delicious, but they do cost, $25.
It reminds me of that Portlandia skit where Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein are so concerned with where the local chicken on a restaurant's menu comes from that they drive to the farm. Florence Fabrikant told me that she feels like screaming every time the chef at a restaurant about to open tells her that he's only using locally produced ingredients as though he's doing something unique.
Well, again, the first restaurant to do that, chefs have always used those ingredients, but in Tom Colicchio, who you just had on, his restaurant Kraft, which is sort of the seminal restaurant of the locally driven movement, because what he did is he took the perfect hen of the woods mushroom, the perfect rutabaga, although I don't think he took rutabagas, but you know what I mean, and he raised them onto this level of fairly subtle New York snobbery. He presented them in the way that these old-fashioned French restaurants used to present their fanciest dishes.
And he even has been growing his own vegetables.
I'm sure. He's a great chef. Why wouldn't he do that? That's what great chefs do. But now they make it's part of the sort of badge of honor.
You've listed steaks for two on your list. Why steaks in particular? Are there other things are being served for two? I recently at Teresi's, and the tasting menu, they offered me short ribs for two at a $35 extra per person. That's $70 on top of the tasting menu short ribs.
I hope you complain bitterly.
I just didn't order it.
Anyway, so beef is in this local sort of meat and potatoes era, obviously steaks are a big deal. Hamburgers had their moment in the sun. For some reason now in New York, you can buy a good steak. It's the best, still the best steak city in the world. But I find myself confronted on a nightly basis by these giant haunches of beef, which often cost more than $100. Well, they're often three figures. And they come with all, they've often, another peeve of mine is they've often, these days, for some reason, there's a, seems to be a competition in how long you age your meat. So you will find, the chefs will tell you, they say, well, this meat has been aged for 120 days, which is, you know, 4 months, 3 months, whatever. And it's, it could be construed as being rotten by some people. And sometimes it's sort of vaguely smells that way.
Well, they have these climate-controlled refrigerators.
I know. It's all good. It's soft. It's tender. It's gamey. But, you know, steak is a, it's something that they pay good money for, but it's also a big, you know, it's very popular, and it's a big money earner. So it's a,
People have been writing in. Abby in Greenwich Village left this comment. She said, I'm a chef, and call me old school, but I can't stand the plating trend of what looks like a blob of sauce that someone has pulled her finger through. It looks like a mistake. Since when is it not okay to pour the sauce over the food?
That's a very good question. But for some reason, you're right. Now they pour it on the plate, and they run a spoon through it, and then they plate things on top of it. And, you know, I actually like that because you can dip, you can move everything around.
Meant to look like art.
It's meant to look like art. Well, it's also better than it used to be. I mean, you used to get in you know, 10 years ago, you would get these plates with splatter that looked like a Jackson Pollock splatter painting. They're a little more elegant now.
Another listener left this comment. Anything with the words craft and artisanal needs to be promptly retired.
I would probably agree with that.
So we do have some people calling in with things that they like, and after we take a little break, maybe we'll talk about those and things that you like. But before we get to the break, do we also see trends in wine lists and cocktail menus?
Well, cocktail trends totally out of hand now. The mixologist trend is actually one of these, the bespoke cocktail, sort of the going back to the old ancient cocktails and dredging these great recipes up and having the mixologists, as they like to call themselves, they don't call themselves bartenders now, with their handlebar mustaches, shaking them around with their vests on. That actually is quite a lovely spectacle, although now you see it everywhere. Every hotel has them. And also what you have now is you have, because it's New York or whatever, these drinks have become, I think, over-creative and over-treacly and sweet, and you see all sorts of bizarre. You know, I had a cocktail at a very good Brooklyn restaurant the other day. And he was one of the main ingredients was kombucha, you know, the yeasty Asian drink, which was mixed, I think, with aquavit. Mm. And it was, thank God it was mixed with aquavit, because that meant we could survive it.
Well, we have seen trends there for a long time. People used to drink whiskey before they had their meal. Then wine kind of took over. More recently, the younger generation has really made a thing about beer and almost made beer into the kind of thing that the previous generation had made wine into.
Another craft product.
And then, more recently, we have the return of whiskey.
Yeah. Well, we live in the great era of brown spirits, I think. It's like the golden age of brown spirits. There's a potted still on every corner in Brooklyn, and I applaud that. I think it's a good thing. Although I'm not a big bourbon fan myself.
And they're making bourbon in Brooklyn. Adam Platt is the food critic for New York Magazine, and we're talking about food trends, both positive and negative. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You can also find us on Facebook. And we will continue after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Adam Platt, who's a food critic for New York Magazine, has been for 10 years. And so over 10 years, he has seen a lot of different trends in food and in restaurants. And we have a bunch of people writing in with ideas about food trends. One person said that her favorite, Tony says his favorite food fad, if you can call it that, is that he's been seeing a revival of home bread baking.
Oh.
We are seeing a lot more of that.
Yeah, I was in a Brooklyn restaurant the other day, and they had this same one with a kombucha, weird kombucha cocktails. They had one of the most delicious, it was a Scandinavian-themed restaurant, very locavore, you know, dining on, you know, crisps of pig's blood and, you know.
Oh, I know about this.
Things
place.
That have been dug up with your hand. You know, who knows? It was very interesting, very good. But almost the best thing was the bread plate, which was this sort of beautiful. It was served on a, again, this being Brooklyn, on a sort of a hand thrown pewter bowl, just hot off the wheel. And it had this, there was this sort of delicate crisp and it wasn't a pat of butter. It was sort of a pool of butter, which had been house churned, and this delicious caraway bread. And I said, so not caraway, it was like scented with something. Like it was a bun, and I ate it in about 5 seconds. And I said, can I have another one? And they went away. And I said, 5 minutes later, I said,
where's my bun?
Where's my damn bun? And they said, sorry, we're baking it. So it was a fresh. It was delicious. And there are other restaurants, Battersby, we talked about in Brooklyn. Also, they have delicious bread. They bake it fresh for you. So it is, again, it's also the golden age of bread baskets.
Well, some people might say Brooklyn itself is something of a food fad.
Yeah, well, I live in Manhattan, and I have been. The whole Brooklyn thing. The thing about the food world in general is there's a desperate appetite for fads. Foodies are always wanting to know the next best thing. They're not wanting to know, really. They're wanting to tell you because they want to tell you they've been somewhere. It's the best. You should go there. So there's this subtle one-upsmanship. Anyway, Brooklyn has filled that void for a long time, and I, as a Manhattanite, thought it was overrated. Brooklyn's overrated. And I think it's true. I think a lot of the restaurants, you go out to Brooklyn, and they were perfectly good, but if you put them in the sort of the great sort of maelstrom of Manhattan, you really wouldn't notice them. But I think this last year or so is the first time that a lot of the restaurants in Brooklyn were really, I think, worth the hype.
And the word has become a brand. We have Brooklyn Brewery. There's a bar near our studios in Soho called the Brooklyneer, which has a Brooklyn theme. Yeah. I was told by a visitor from Paris that if you want to say something is really hip in Paris, you say, it's so Brooklyn.
Yeah. You know, this Scandinavian restaurant that I was just talking about, I'm sure in Sweden they would call it a Brooklyn restaurant. Anyway, and obviously the whole Brooklyn thing's out of hand, and, you know, I understand that, but I've come late to the whole Brooklyn food party. I think there's a lot of good food out there.
Well, we've been concentrating on food so far, but there's also another part of a restaurant experience. One trend you've said that you're tired of is rocks and moss and lichen as dining props. Now, how do you think they came to replace flowers or the small cactus, which was once a little trend?
Well, you know, it's the obvious sort of reductive end of the great locavore craze. You know what a locavore is. Locavores only eat what's within a certain radius of where they live. In New York, if you live in this sort of cement-bound apartment, that can be difficult. But the rocks and the lichen is that's another trend which has come to us from Scandinavia, although there are restaurants like this in Portland all over the place. And basically, I've called it oat forager cuisine, which is there's actually a very good restaurant in Tribeca called Atera, a very good young chef from Portland, and he does a little tasting menu. And
Acme also has a foraging.
Acme is another. That's a Scandinavian chef. And at Acme, they sort of, if you go there in the wintertime, I mean, Acme is like a swinging hip place. But the dish they're most proud of is this sort of huge charred Jerusalem artichoke, which looks like it looks like it's just survived some kind of great conflagration. No longer do they give you frites and burgers. It's like you have to go, wow, I'm really digging this Jerusalem artichoke. Anyway, Atera has these props, moss and lichen. And again, I really like Atera. I gave it a very good review. But this sort of aspect of preciousness about what are incredibly natural ingredients, not even ingredients, things of nature, which can be a little cloying at times.
A listener, Robin, has called in. Robin, hi, you're on the air. Robin from Harlem.
Hi, I have a friend who's thinking of opening a restaurant. What's the next new, geographically speaking, the next new hottest area in the city that's up and coming?
Hasn't Harlem started being the site of a number of hot restaurants?
Probably Robin in Harlem can tell you that, maybe.
Well, Marcus Samuelson.
Marcus Samuelson has a new restaurant. It's actually not that new anymore. You know, there are regions of the city which are perpetually up and coming. And, you know, Harlem's got some good restaurants now. The Upper West Side is perpetually up and coming, but never quite there.
Well, how much of this is about rents? Because wherever we've seen these new restaurants pop up, when the Lower East Side was low rent, suddenly we saw a bunch of restaurants there. Then Brooklyn, because that's where an ambitious young chef could find a space for very little money. They go to the areas that are becoming gentrified.
Yeah, a lot of it's about rents, especially now because in Manhattan the rents are so high. You used to have in Manhattan, you'd have pockets of Manhattan where you could go and open a restaurant cheaply, and that's harder and harder to do. Not only is it harder and harder to do, the pressure on you if you have a big lease is you're going to serve the kind of food that you think people will like. So you'll serve safe food, like in New York, that's Italian, that's steak, that's chicken and salmon. In Brooklyn, not only do you have lower rents, but you also have this growing population of very educated eaters. The new generation of eaters, they don't like to eat at fancy French restaurants, but they're much more knowledgeable than their parents were about where things come from, how things taste, flavor combinations. And they live in Brooklyn, and also the chefs live in Brooklyn. So you have this sort of, perfect. It's not a perfect storm, but it's a good environment for good food.
But have you noticed that for a time you'll see a bunch of restaurants opening up, and they all look like they could have had their menus printed at the same place? They have all the hot new dishes, whether it's short ribs or suddenly raw bars have become popular again. Or sunchokes, or everyone has pretty much the same menu, pork belly,
right?
Everywhere.
Yeah.
What do you think is happening there? Are they just imitating each other?
Yeah, they're imitating each other.
And,
and
that's because they're hoping to make money?
Well, they're imitating each other because trends are trends because they become popular. So over the last 10 years, the city has been roiled by a succession of really comfort food trends. I talked about the burger. Burgers were a big hot thing on every menu. Now most restaurants, if you want to be successful in New York, certainly in Manhattan, you will have a hamburger that costs over $17, $18, done with the fanciest meat, bread baked, blah, blah, blah.
And they tell you where they got the meat.
Oh, yeah, where they got it.
The Fritas.
How it's done. They talk about the burger-to-bun ratio. My friends at Pat LaFrieda will go on and on about all these things. There are hamburger blogs, hamburger snobs, hamburger loons. Also, you had meatballs. None of them have been as successful as the hamburgers.
And Sydney in the East Village points out that squid ink has suddenly become a big thing. He's seen it smeared on his plate and ingested squid ink, soaked breadcrumbs. It's all flash, he says. Or is it all flash, or does it actually lend any flavor? Or does it help to boost the price?
I haven't given a lot of thought to squid ink recently.
But it's all over the place.
I think you could maybe say it's all over the place. Squid inks have been around for quite a while. But, I see squid ink. You know, they use it to, say, at this restaurant Aterra, which I've talked about, they use it to paint the shell, the faux clam shell, which is really made out of bread. They use it to paint the shell, and it looks actually like a perfect razor clam.
One listener says that he's happy that one trend is that restaurants are banning cell phone use.
Yeah, well, okay. Part of that is obviously you don't want to hear somebody babble on their cell phone. It's also there's a whole controversy over taking your pictures of your food.
Somebody asked about social media, whether you think that that has affected food trends.
It's made food. I'm all in favor of that, of tweeting about your food, and of I'm in favor of taking pictures about your food. I'm a Twitter person. I enjoy seeing pictures of food. I take pictures of food all the time, so I'm in favor of it. In these fancy omakase restaurants that we were talking about, the chefs will bar you from that in a snobby way. I'm against it.
Well, I'm waiting to see every restaurant in New York be gluten-free. My guest is Adam Platt, food critic for New York Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you, all of you who have written in to tell us about the food trends that you like and dislike.